Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And welcome to the Partly Political Broadcast, the podcast that takes a fresh look at the past week's news, or at least it did, but no deal preparations mean that all looks are now stockpiled and in tins. This is episode 136, I'm Tin and Duyeb, and happy not Brexit week. Obviously, I know you're all disappointed because your Brexit street parties have had to be cancelled for Saturdays, and I bet in line with the occasion you hadn't planned anything at all and just assumed that it would happen without conferring with anyone or checking what needed to be authorised, and you just assumed they'd let you do what you wanted and had ready stockpiled cans of roast dinners and instant cake powder to hand round. But hey, we still might be leaving in April or May or never, and does it matter? Because Prime Minister and hard-boiled shoe Theresa May has promised that she is on the public side like a fucking thorn. And MPs have voted to take back control, but only for a little bit on a Wednesday, in order to get votes that won't really mean anything. It's a bit like saying, yeah, let's go fourth gear down a residential road, and then being too scared to go into fifth on the motorway. For a long time now, there's been no single definitive answer to many of the questions surrounding Brexit. The answer to what is Brexit, for example, could well be either the result of an ill-thought pipe dream by blustering elite fuckknuckles and a disillusioned public. It could be the catastrophic tantrum conjured by adult babies and forced upon an austerity-hit nation. Maybe it's the natural consequence and sum of a pandering to the far right, years of privatisation and a swine-fancying Prime Minister whose greatest achievement involved walking off camera after an interview before you could swear at the telly. Or maybe, the answer is it's just car crash airbag filled with mince Boris Johnson's fevered wet dream night terror realised. Any of those would do, plus some more sensible answers, no doubt. The question, why is Brexit, has, well, very similar answers, but with some added ones about a stubborn need of the government to hit their head against a table repeatedly and say that it's progress. Or maybe it's the notion that Britain is the world's best country, combined with an insistence that we mustn't let anyone come here to check in case they realise it's really not. Who is Brexit? Now, that's a much harder question. I mean, Brexit could be Johnny Depp, because although he's attractive to many, most of the rest of us have very much realised that he's abusive and overrated, but still find it very hard to avoid him when he's in absolutely everything. Maybe it's Michael Jackson, because, you know, Brexit spent a lot of money in order to ruin children's lives, but many are turning a blind eye to it because they've been enjoying the idea of it for 40 years and still really like the early stuff. Or more likely, Brexit is Theresa May, who, after failing to get the extension date she wanted from the EU and being handed two other choices by them, announced that she was making an urgent speech on Wednesday night. She promised it for 10:15, but she didn't arrive at the podium until nearly 10:45, proving she's unable to deliver absolutely anything on time. And then rather than, as many were hoping, an understanding that much like a really stubborn giant tumour, that she needs to be removed before Britain has any sort of hopes of survival for the future, May insisted that she knew the public had had enough and blamed politicians for talking about nothing else and avoiding making a choice. Yes, this from the woman whose catchphrase, Brexit means Brexit, meant she was using the portmanteau at least twice as many times as anyone else, a woman who insists on returning exactly the same unwanted deal each time in order to avoid having to consider anything else, and who is also very much a politician. I'm starting to wonder if Theresa May has dissociative identity disorder, and at some point she'll just go to look in the mirror and have a moment of clarity and have to send everyone in the Commons one of those giant Clinton's apology cards. Who am I kidding? She'll never have a moment of clarity. We all know that the closest we get to May stepping down would be her saying, resigning is resigning 400 times, before spending 2 years stuck at number 10, unable to find a viable way to leave. This, of course, hasn't stopped others from trying to make her leave, and an unsuccessful, albeit probably didn't try very hard, may not have even been anything more than a distraction tool, coup, supposedly happened over the weekend. The Times, the newspaper that is the answer to what if the Sun could actually construct sentences, scooped that Tory MPs plan to oust May, with her replacement being either, get this, Jeremy, I'd probably end up forgetting my keys and sleeping on the doorstep of number 11 because I wouldn't even know where I lived, Hunt, Michael, Larry the cat wouldn't stop hissing at him because animals can sense evil, Gove, or David, we can't have a Prime Minister who every time he appears on TV or meets global leaders, they and we all ask, but who is that? Lidlington. Every time. That would happen every single time. Who is he? Can you remember his face? No. While all of those options feel very much like hiring an arsonist with a petrol-filled hose in order to tackle a blaze, I guess out of all three of them, Michael Gove would make the best caretaker Prime Minister. But that's only because he looks like he's wearing a rubber mask and would run around upsetting kids. Lidlington denied a coup was happening and said that he was 100% behind the Prime Minister, which of course is the perfect position to stab her in the back from. And Gove said that it wasn't time to change captain of the ship, I'm guessing because it's sinking anyway, so it's best just to scrabble around looking for lifeboats. It was, of course, all over before it started, showing that Conservatives, once a party that, despite all their other awful, really awful qualities, you could always say were a well-oiled, or perhaps in many cases, oily machine. But now it seems that they even fail at coups to get rid of a failing Prime Minister who's failing to push through a failing project. Their old phrase of you can trust the Conservatives with the economy may now have to be replaced, as many would just imagine they'd lose the economy down the back of a car seat and then bang their head every time they tried to look for it. What could that story have been a distraction from, you ask, remembering the very brief thing I said several minutes ago? Well done, you're really paying attention. I'm very impressed. See me after class. Well, the non-cuckoo took up the front pages of various papers on Sunday instead of the anti-Brexit People's Vote March, which happened on Saturday with between 1 and 2 million people taking part because apparently, according to much of the media, several people continuing to not have a clue about what they're doing is, of course, much more important than millions of people very clearly stating what they do want or rather don't. I mean, I say clearly, but some were there demanding a people's vote because they still somehow have faith in humanity, despite everything. Some wanted a full-on revocation of Article 50, and some just wanted you to see the excellent way they've done a lovely pun on the EU for their banner. But the overall message was that it's not working, and to prove it, they used their freedom of movement to stomp all over London and say so. It was constantly reported that two protests were happening over the weekend, even though the other protest that was mentioned was the March for Leave, which was kind of more of an unhealthy ramble. It wasn't much of a comparison, really, as numbers for that varied between 50 to 100, depending on which car park they were congregating in. But despite this, of course, blowtorched guppy Nigel Farage said that those on the People's Vote March didn't represent the people, even though they were people from everywhere representing themselves. He said instead that the 100 March for Leave participants were a symbol for millions of Brexit voters who either weren't enthused or are so hardline that they're afraid to leave their villages. Of course, by this logic, then the millions of People's Vote marchers must also represent billions or even trillions of Remainers, so fuck you, Farage. Meanwhile, an online parliamentary petition to revoke Article 50 has now received well over 5 million signatures, though pro-Brexit critics say it's all down to bots, which it isn't. Though if it was, then fair play that this is all such a shit show that even bots have changed their minds since 2016 and have swapped sides. Yes, Brexit is now such a mess that even autonomous programmes think it's a bad idea. Which brings us back to the big Brexit questions, and the next one is, when is Brexit? Now, many showed that they hope it's never, and now it definitely won't be this week, and it possibly might be April. The EU gave the sort of concessions you'd give a 17-year-old with a beard trying to buy an Alco Pop, and while refusing to extend Article 50 until June the 30th, they said it could now be extended till April the 12th or May the 22nd, depending on if anyone comes up with any good ideas or has any hopes of enjoying the Easter break that could be trampled over. May called an emergency meeting on Sunday at Chequers to discuss bringing back her vote for a third time, and she did that with the sort of diverse cast that you'd only find on a comedy panel show. This included Bin Bag Full of Dead Leaves, Boris Johnson, Pepper Army mascot Dominic Raab, the rejected third member of Sparks, Jacob Rees-Mogg, Curdled Milk Made Human, David Davis, hate-filled Boyle, Ian Duncan Smith, constantly looks like he's taking a shit, Julian Smith, Tom from Father Ted, Brandon Lewis, stock photo of an idiot, Steve Barclay, Alistair Burt, who I didn't even know was a politician and really looks like a penis wearing glasses, definitely a penis wearing glasses, Michael Gove, David Lidlington, who looks like, no wait, nope, still can't remember, and wanker Damian Green. Steve Baker, aka Bert from Sesame Street's Disturbed Cousin, also turned up like a fly excited by a manure convention. Ian Duncan Smith, when he arrived, did so in a classic sports car with the roof down, in one of the few moments I really wished I'd had the abilities to conjure an army of birds to shit on command. Yes, nothing says future of modern Britain like 13 middle-aged white men racing to tell one woman what she should do. It was revealed afterwards that the group referred to themselves as the Grand Wizards, which either they haven't thought about at all, or they have, and that's worse. Though credit where it's due, despite the Conservatives being inherently racist and KKK references being unsurprising, if I did see Boris, IDS or Rob wandering around in a full Klan outfit, I'd automatically assume they'd got stuck in their duvets and were too stupid to work out how to escape it and too stubborn to admit anything at all was wrong and that it was all going to plan. The result of these meetings, well, they obviously went well because Boris Johnson wrote in the Telegraph that May needed to channel the spirit of Moses in Exodus and say to Brussels, "Let my people go." Forgetting, of course, that Moses was supposedly born in Egypt, so if May did channel him, she'd probably have to deport herself pretty quickly, which, to be fair, might be a very good solution. During her comment statement on Monday, May ruled out a meaningful vote for this week, which of course didn't rule out any meaningless votes or even several pointless ones, and she mentioned that no deal was now not going to happen while still mentioning that it can't be ruled out, and then hinted at a second referendum being a possibility but also not. BBC chief political correspondent Vicky Young tweeted that she had no idea what Theresa May's Brexit strategy was, which both simultaneously proved that the BBC are perfectly in line with public opinion, and at the same time, by Vicky presuming she had a strategy, showed that BBC are still more pro-government than they should be. To be properly non-partisan, Vicky Young should have said, "This has all gone completely tits up, I'm going to put my head in a bin now, please come and shake me when it's all over." May instead told the Commons that there was now her Brexit, no Brexit or slow Brexit, which I believe they're going to be practicing on the next series of Strictly, and mainly involves going round and round in a circle while gurning constantly for 2 years before repeatedly falling over your own feet and onto your arse. That, of course, wasn't the end of the stupid for the day, and following this, during Brexit debate log stardate 96830.16, Labour MP and wraith that feeds off people's confused faces, because how else do you explain her, Kate Hoey, told Parliament that she doesn't call no deal no deal, but instead calls it a different type of deal that would take us out. Sure, Kate, except it's still an absence of deal, which is why it's no deal. It's like me saying that I don't call what Kate Hoey says bullshit, just a different type of lying or ignorance that also happens to be massively shit. Then on Monday night, three more ministers, who I would name but you won't know them or care, resigned from the government to vote for the Letwin Amendment, which was not only proof of nominative determinism, but also a significant constitutional change that means Parliament will get control of Brexit for one day on Wednesday, at which point it'll probably vote for indicative votes, which won't really count for anything, but will indicate what votes MP may have that do count for things in the future. Yeah, taking back control of a very small part of things to push for things that don't mean anything. Yeah, basically it's all still pointless, but sort of symbolic that it may not be because the government lost and MPs won, etc, etc. I'll tell you what's symbolic. We have May, the daughter of a clergyman, regularly losing ministers, which makes Brexit look a bit like her delayed teenage rebellion against her dad. Is that what it's all about? Is it? Then, minutes after voting to take back control, Parliament then voted against the Beckett Amendment to have a vote on no deal if there was still no deal 7 days before the exit day. And that is Margaret Beckett, not Samuel Beckett, despite what you'd think. So they kind of said, hey, let's have control, but don't go overboard. Ugh, bit much, know what I mean? And now, of course, we should ask, how is Brexit? And still, no one really knows, though while we may get to hear some alternatives right now, I'd hazard a guess at unwell. In other politics news, as if there is any, Labour MPs voted to remove Ian, I've got such a tiny face, Austin, and Mike, the exact opposite in terms of face size, Gapes, from the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, on account of them no longer being Labour MPs and them taking up Labour places. However, Austin and Gapes both said they were booted off because they stood against racism. But it's a bit odd that they left the party but still wanted the party allocated places. It's almost as though absolutely no one in Parliament has any idea what happens when you leave any sort of political group ever. Former Prime Minister and man who in every appearance he makes looks like he's being further corrupted by the ring, Tony Blair, says police are losing the knife crime fighting battle, but that is probably because they're not used to wielding blades as it's not part of their training. In global news, the long-awaited Mueller report has been released and it found that, yes, corners are better than rice. Ha! How many have made that joke? Yeah, that's right, everyone... Everyone that shit. No, seriously, the report by Special Counsel Robert Mueller found that the Trump campaign had not conspired with Russia. Because, I mean, let's face it, if you really think about it, how could a man who can't work out how to get an umbrella on a plane do secret collusion? But it hasn't cleared the US President and colostomy bag full of iron brew Donald Trump of obstructing justice, which is entirely plausible as he was capable on his UK visit of obstructing the Queen without much effort whatsoever. This is just a summary of the report, and Democrats are demanding public access to the full document. But Trump has, of course, claimed all of this as a victory, saying that it was an illegal takedown that failed, despite it being a legal takedown that resulted in jail sentences for five of his colleagues and possibly another two who are awaiting sentencing. But I guess how would he know? He is probably unable to see any of the justice for being in the way of it. And lastly, back in the UK, leader of the House and mother, Andrea Leadsom, said parents should be able to choose when children are exposed to LGBT issues. So weird that she could be prejudiced against people with different sexual preferences to herself, especially when her kids and everyone else's are still unshielded from seeing the Conservatives fuck everyone and everything. Hey, hey you, how goes it? Are you well? I'm not, it's past midnight. I'm recording this week, bloody hell. When will people stop the politics? The politics went on for bloody ages tonight, and then I recorded this all and forgot to actually record it. So, good work. Anyway, did you go to the People's Vote March? Did you have fun? I didn't go, that is, or have fun, actually, because it seems that when deciding to be a parent, I missed the small print that said you also have to be a host to different unwelcome germ visitors every week. And last week, the mini Duyeb got some horrible stomach bug gastroenteritis thing, which she then very kindly passed on to us. And the weekend was spent with the blinds down, hoping no one in the outside world would witness the horrors within, as I pleaded for someone to daub a red cross on our door, for monks to stand outside warding people away, and some sort of exorcist to visit. I swear all I do every week is tell you what illnesses that my family has had, and I realise now that it's almost entirely down to the soft play centre, which appears to just be a squishy petri dish of horrors. Last time we took the tiny one there, she got hand, foot and mouth, then she got a cold from a friend's party, and then this time, Liberace's vomit fountain. I've decided that she's not allowed to meet any other children ever again, and she'll only socialise with adults from now on. And I fully expect that by the time she's eight, she'll have some great chat about rent prices and parenting, while having an immune system so fragile she could get taken down by the mere suggestion that something flew. But I hope that you had fun if you went. That's what's very important. If you didn't go, I fully respect that as well. I think there's lots of reasons not to go as well as reasons to go. I'm still not sure personally that a people's vote is the right way forward for so many reasons, mainly that people's still keep screwing up votes every time and time again, and I really feel that maybe it should be the animals' turn now. Thank you for listening again, and hello to new listeners who heard the croaky voice shit from last week and still somehow thought it was worth sticking around for another one. You be good people, and as you can hear, another croaky voiced one, because it's 9 minutes past midnight. Bloody hell. How long will this week's episode last, topically? I've only recorded it after the votes tonight, so hopefully it will last at least a day. And then when this is all over, I think we all need a holiday. All of us. Depending on how it goes, I swear the government should pay for all of Britain to have a beach trip, probably to somewhere in Europe. I think that would be fitting. I've got to do a gig in Brussels this week on Wednesday, and I was genuinely worried something would happen and I'd be trapped there till Friday and then I'd have to get smuggled back. The gig is for the European Transport Workers Federation, though, so to be fair, if anyone had the means to get me on board a train or a boat to do it, it would be them, so it probably would work out. Slightly terrified about the show is it's hosting the stage at their big protest for equal pay and treatment, and Brexit has been so all-consuming that my European politics knowledge is slim to none. I know some people in high vis are upset in France, and that's all I know. There are apparently be about 3,000 to 5,000 people there, so how loudly can they boo? I mean, yeah, quite loud, yeah. Oh, well, anyway, quick admin thing. Thanks to Farron, Conal and Hazel for donating to the Ko-fi this week. I haven't actually bought any coffees for the last few days because, what with the gastroenteritis, I thought probably wouldn't help. But I will use them all this week, so very much appreciated. And if you are able to donate towards the show, or at least my usual caffeine intake during it, please donate at Ko-fi, that's ko-fi.com/parpobro, and that link is in the podcast blurb because I'm good like that. Or you can also donate for no specific beverage choice at patreon.com/parpobro. And if you can't do that, please review the show. At least that's free. You can do that for free as many times you like. I think just once. iTunes or Apple Podcast or Tim Apple's Funhouse or whatever you call it. On there, the show is 9 reviews away from 150 reviews. So come on, let's all reach a number that doesn't really mean anything other than sounding more satisfying than 141. Does it sound more satisfying? No. 141. It's a nice interstate. Here we go. 141. 141. It's quite fun, isn't it? But 166. That sounds better, right? 166. 166. It's really pleasing, isn't it? So let's get there. Let's get to that number. Of course, if you can't do either of those things, or you've already done those things, but you're just eager for more, then please get on your social medias, your blog sites, your GeoCities homepages, and your MSN Messenger web chats, and tell other people to get involved with some of those semicolon, close bracket, smiley face things that all the kids do nowadays. And the only other thing this week is that, as I plugged last week, the How Does This Politics Thing Work Then Kids show that I do is at the Pound Arts Centre in Corsham this week on Saturday the 30th. I've said this week twice, haven't I? Well, it's this week. And it's on Saturday the 30th, which I think will now have the Brexit bit that it usually has, but just sort of with different dates. Oh, God, who knows? Who knows what will happen by Saturday? But tickets are nearly all gone for that. So if you live in the Corsham vicinity, it is suitable for children aged 6+. It doesn't have any of the swears that this show does. And it starts at 2 p.m. And you can get tickets from the Pound Arts website. So please do come along. This week's show has expert in political violence Kieran Gillespie on, political violence. I mean, it'd be stupid talking to him about something he hasn't got a clue about, so I didn't do that. You know, hey, Kieran, let's chat about pies. I mean, he might know about pies. I'm not going to assume that he doesn't, but you know what I'm saying. Anyway, plus there is a look at the collapse of Interserve that you didn't know about. No, you didn't. Don't lie. And, of course, a whole load of stuff on Brexit that I really debated discussing, because who knows if any of it will matter. That is the one plus side of Brexit I've really learned to prioritise. Have this, you chumps. The phrase, learn from your mistakes, is meant to mean, you know, that when you fuck up, you're then aware of how not to fuck up in that exact way all over again. But when it comes to the British government, all they seem to learn from their mistakes is how to carry them out in almost exactly the same way again. Like each mistake is some sort of training for a bigger, worse mistake. Like preliminary runs before a marathon that mostly involves you sitting still and crawling a bit. Case in point, just 1 year after Carillion collapsed, Interserve went into administration 10 days ago. If you're like me, that's probably news to you on account of not knowing what Interserve even is. And no, it's not a fetish involving wanting your partner to dress as waiting staff. Interserve is one of the biggest government contractors, in charge of £2 billion worth of projects, such as £35 million contract at King George Hospital in London for cleaning, security, meals, waste management, and, you know, all the stuff that isn't medical and is really needed to stop doctors and nurses having to wade through four-day-old dinners and a sea of urine in order to get to patients. Though, of course, it would make Casualty a far more interesting show. Obviously, with that many contracts, it means they also employ 45,000 people in the UK, 68,000 people around the world, which, however you look at it, is a lot of people. Go and try. Look at it upside down. Yep, still a lot. How about diagonally? Still loads. Told you. So how on earth did the government let yet another outsourcing firm go under? Well, the company ended up with £115 million of debt due to cancelled projects and delays, which makes my credit card look an awful lot better. And a debt reduction rescue plan was put into place, which should have cancelled half the debt and left the shareholders with just 5% between them. But US hedge fund called Train, who are nowhere near as jazzy as they sound, and who own just under a third of shares and who don't care about your hospital meals or lakes of piss in intensive care, rebelled against it, which completely wiped out all the small shareholders who'd voted for it. Instead, an accountancy firm called EY, which I guess is pronounced A as they just slide in to take over the administration, they say they've secured all the jobs and the contracts for the time being. But no one's sure how long that time is being, and when it stops being, then oh dear, will time start being awful. But what's super odd, or perhaps not odd and entirely unsurprising, is that despite knowing about Interserve's financial difficulties, the government awarded them £660 million of contracts, including a £66 million deal with the Foreign Office to run facilities management services. Even by December, when the company announced their debt for equity rescue deal and basically shouted, hey, we're drowning and absolutely not waving, even then, they were awarded another £7 million of public contracts. This is also despite ministers supposedly being so worried about Interserve's failure that they drew up plans to renationalise all their operations. Now, look, I don't mean to take this personally, but as a self-employed bod, I've recently had to have two credit checks, handover bank statements and accountant statements, and a note from my current landlord saying I've paid rent every month on time for 5 years in order to be accepted to rent a new flat. Yet if I just said, hey, I'm £800 million in debt and I'm really scared right now, then the government would have seen me as a viable contractor and lumped me with DOSH. I really feel like I'm doing things the wrong way round. The GMB union have said that the whole ordeal shows how obsessed the government become with outsourcing. And in a way, I do understand. I mean, if you had Chris Grayling or Jeremy Hunt on your team, you'd want to delegate work to almost anyone else ever. But it's clear from not only Interserve and Carillion before it, but also Serco with its treatment of asylum seekers, or G4S with its forgetting to turn up half the time, all this outsourcing is not working. And at least some services need to be renationalised in order to ensure their safety. While EY has said that those employed by Interserve will have safe jobs for now, that could change. Meanwhile, the CEO of InterServe, Debbie White, looks set to keep her job and receive a 50% salary boost for last year, with pay packages of £1 million. Now, you could say the government definitely aren't learning from their mistakes, but the CEO of Carillion, Keith Cochrane, only left with a salary of £750,000, so I think they are learning, they're just getting entirely the wrong lesson, and I'd very much like to point out that mistake to them, but I'm concerned that if they learn from it, just what it might lead to. When I was younger, it was very fun to point your hand joints at people and make them roar before shouting, "They're terrorists," but I'm reckoning that's the only time that terrorism can ever be remotely fun. The disturbing shooting at two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand, just over a week ago by a white supremacist raised a lot of questions about terrorism that were being asked before, but not many people were really listening. What is causing the rise in fascism, asked all the newspapers who'd plastered anti-immigration statements all over their front pages for years. Is far-right white supremacist terrorism now more of a threat than Islamic terrorism, said large chunks of the media before referring to the gunman as angel-haired and ignoring all the victims. And is it all social media's fault, as Facebook allowed the killer to stream the murders live, asked the Mail and the Mirror before they popped it up on their websites, just in case you missed it and needed something fun to view with your tea. That's a tricky question, though, really, because while Twitter and Facebook definitely seem to be online fascist nurseries, they're also the only platforms where you can actively tell them to fuck off outside of a march. But despite warnings and concerns about all those things from people in the know for many years, those are still very valid and important questions, as is wondering if we're now in times of exceptional political violence, whether that's terrorist attacks or death threats to MPs, or me just wanting to smash my telly in every time I hear Theresa May make a completely pointless speech. Is it all down to political discourse, or would Twitter adding a dislike button really change things? Most importantly, how do we stop this from happening again and again for the sake of the victims? And of course, my TV. This week, I asked those questions to Kieran Gillespie, a teaching fellow at the University of Surrey who specialises in international politics and security, and as part of that, terrorism and political violence. I saw him being very good about it all on Channel 4 News for all of about 30 seconds, and I contacted him to see if he'd be happy talking to me for a much longer time so that, you know, he'd actually be allowed to explain things. Luckily, Kieran managed to fit in a chat between lectures and flying off to a conference in Canada, and I hope that you'll find this as engaging and thought-provoking as I did. Still, though, terrorists, it's pretty good, isn't it? It's pretty funny. Terrorists, Okay, so first question, it's one that I know has been flying around a lot at the moment after the horrific New Zealand terrorist attack where the killer sort of live-streamed shooting. Is social media, in your opinion, Kieran, aiding a rise in terrorism and the radicalisation of terrorists?
Well, it's a very good question. I think it's the question that's been on everyone's lips this week. I've been asked it a couple of times. I don't think that there's a satisfactory kind of yes or no answer, which is the immediate like academic response to anything like this, is to qualify to the nth degree anything that anyone says about it, because and unfortunately there's a reason for it, because the more that you actually delve into the academic realm of the study of terrorism, political violence, radicalization, you find that the boundaries for definitions of things are very murky, very ambiguous. And more than that, the causal processes in violence, saying one thing leads to another, are extremely contentious and very difficult to prove. That being said, it would be my position that I don't think that social media creates anything that wasn't there already, or that in terms of radicalization isn't creating something that didn't exist in mainstream political discourse previously, because we know this in relation to acts of terrorism by white supremacists, because that kind of terrorism predates the internet, right? So in any kind of foundational sense, it's not a case of white men were all fine until YouTube came along, and then something really strange happened, and we started to get very funny ideas about using political violence on people of other races, because clearly history tells us that is not true. What it can be is to augment or alter processes of radicalization in ways that maybe we didn't expect, or that are difficult to understand. But definitely my kind of strong response to this question, either from students or from the media this week, has been to say, you know, it's comforting to tell ourselves that platforms like YouTube or Facebook, or even, you know, the dark corners of the internet like 8chan, 4chan, are doing something to young white men that you know, we don't understand, when actually all we need to do is look at mainstream political discourse in the last few years to see that this is, you know, this is not something that we, you know, that is only to do with young people, and it's certainly not something only to do with the internet. This is this kind of heavy Islamophobic, anti-immigrant, misogynist political discourse has been legitimated in a lot of mainstream areas. You know, these two things are interacting with each other, if anything. You know, it's certainly not that the online space is creating them.
Sure. I mean, it's something. I mean, I've been very aware of kind of anti-Islamic sentiment in a lot of political speeches, a lot of political policies for quite some time, and pretty much since sort of 9/11, I think it's kind of exacerbated. But what I have become aware of, I think, is in terms of the kind of extremist Islamic groups, I've heard a lot of ISIS recruitment is now done online through various Instagram messaging or WhatsApp groups or things. And obviously, as I said, with the New Zealand attacks, we had the Facebook video. So even if social media isn't the cause, I mean, it must now aid, in reaching audiences far more or far greater than these kind of radicalist groups could do before.
Yeah, no, I mean, I do agree with that in terms of like, as a facilitation of messaging, certainly, I mean, in terms of formal recruitment for extremist organizations, Islamic militancy and things like that, you know, like the platforms do provide a kind of functional bridge between audiences separated by large spaces. That is reality. Like there's been a huge amount of discussion about, you know, ISIS's the quality, the quantity of ISIS's online kind of political presence in recent years. Again, there's this question about the mainstream impact of this. You know, like to what extent you attribute radicalization in, you know, young Muslim men and women going to Syria to fight with ISIS in the last year is that, you know, again, that everything was normal until they came across a website or read a copy of ISIS's magazine, The Bic or something, and then all of a sudden you're radicalized. This is something that, interestingly enough, you know, something you come across a lot in the security services reaction to something like 7/7, the 7/7 bomb attacks, the reports that kind of come out in relation to radicalization by a commission of police chief commissioners in that time. And in the language there, you see this idea that I think does have kind of deep roots in security sector responses to terrorism. The idea that it's a poisonous ideology. Any kind of terrorist radicalization is to do with a poisonous ideology, and that, you know, otherwise normal people encounter it and then you get brainwashed and then all of a sudden, you know, you're in Syria fighting with ISIS. And I don't think that that's how these processes work. There's a much deeper kind of societal causal process that I'm not sure we even really understand yet fully, but like certainly the research would indicate, you know, this is something to do with, you know, how you perceive yourself in a society. So it's, you know, it's much more broadly about the politics of the society that you find yourself in, whether that's in the UK or France or in Syria. It's about your perception of what's politically achievable, what things are impacting your own perceptions of your security, your sovereignty. And those are the kind of things that act, again, in conjunction with slick radicalizing media online to create people who are capable of carrying out acts of tremendous violence.
Yes, that's fascinating. I'm plugging now another podcast on my podcast, which is a weird thing to do, but there was a fantastic New York Times podcast called Caliphate, which I don't know if you've listened to or aware of.
I haven't heard it, but I've heard very good things about it. So I will definitely.
It's incredible. Again, I'm now selling someone else's podcast on mine, but there you go. It's properly incredible and just fantastic investigative journalism. And a lot of the very interesting thing on there was that, you know, she interviews people who were in ISIS and have now left. And a lot of them middle class and felt very disillusioned at the state of things and the way in which Middle Eastern countries were treated. And then there are people in Middle Eastern countries who had horrific intervention by US soldiers and that turned them twice and things like that. And I wondered if, looking now at white supremacism, which is on the rise, are we seeing a rise in that because of, you know, austerity and Brexit and various other things that have come in the same way that a new IRA seems to have surfaced after all the issues in Ireland now because of Brexit? Have we now got these as bigger concerns because of the way that political discourse has changed?
Yeah, well, I think the discourse probably reflects aspects of social reality. One thing I tend to think about in these situations is that, you know, there's this question of what is happening in particularly in Western society, if we're talking about, you know, the radicalization in young white men, that is attributable to an interaction between social factors and questions of identity. And I think a lot of the time when we talk about things like terrorism and political violence, you know, this is the hardcore edge of security, right? This is guns and bombs. This is the state, you know, responses to this. You know, it's intelligence, and you know, it's the glamorous kind of world of espionage we see on TV and stuff. And when you start talking about things like identity, people can sometimes roll their eyes and just be like, yeah, okay. Or you're like saying, I'm using a feminist analysis to kind of, you know, review this kind of thing. If people roll their eyes and go like, that's kind of wishy-washy stuff. But actually, you know, I think it's much more kind of a mainstream consideration than people tend to think. You know, it was in the 80s and 90s, you know, the hardcore kind of intelligence service kind of response to radicalization was to look at places, you know, to look in places like Yemen and Egypt and Algeria and, you know, places all across the Middle East and say, you know, these places are hotbeds for radicalization because you have large population of young men who have been locked out of the political process because, you know, they don't have representation. They live in autocracies, you know, in many cases, autocracies supported by the West. And they don't have much in the way of prospects. The economies are stagnant. There's not much chance of them developing a materially improved way of life, and they are very angry. Now, I think that you can quite easily use that as a description for quite a lot of populations in the Western world as well today, right? You're talking about disillusioned. People with, you know, feeling increasingly desperate and feeling increasingly locked out of political processes that are controlled by an unassailable elite, and feeling very angry. And I think that anger has expressed itself in a whole range of different political potentialities. Some people are organizing, some people are fighting back in ways that challenge elite consensus politics and challenge reductive and racist discourse, but other people are falling in the other way and becoming more extreme in a kind of racist, misogynist backlash as well. And you're seeing that, I think, very, very clearly expressed in something like Christchurch. But, you know, there's been incidents all along the way, from Elliot Rodger and Santa Barbara's kind of claimed incel uprising to Dylan Roof in Charlottesville. You know, there's these cases of men who feel entitled by writ of their identity to both access to women and a dominant position in society. And the fact that these things, you know, in a post-Me Too, post Black Lives Matter kind of online political context, feel that their position as dominant just by of their identity is under threat, and they're very angry about that, and I think that that's quite dangerous.
I was going to say, I try to think of how to put that. I've often seen it come up on social media, and lots of often male commentators dismiss it, but it is nearly always men, and men seems to be the issue. Is there a reason for that? Is it just that, you know, with a world that's sort of a very patriarchal society, if men feel threatened, they feel like they're going to lose everything? What's the reason for that?
Well, I mean, that's this is one of the core kind of interests of things like feminist security studies, and I think that the incredible utility of using those lenses. I actually had this, had students debating this week. Obviously, it's very, it's a motive issue, and people want to talk about it, and had students talk about it. And I did have a student, mention this week, that and I think in a way they are very much trying to express a reflection on what it means to be male by saying, men are aggressive, men are, we are, that's just the kind of the biological nature of us, that, we are kind of hunter gatherers by design, and so it's when we get backed into a corner, we act aggressively and this kind of thing. And I think, that while that maybe that sounds like a kind of self-critical reflection, it's a kind of a biological determinist argument that I think has been pretty, as far as certainly a lot of social, political, academic scholarship on the subject is being pretty roundly dismissed in recent years, in recent decades, actually, all following on from work like Judith Butler's on the performance of masculinity. We kind of understand that our gender, what it means to be masculine, is something that's a socially constructed process, right? It's what it means to be masculine is going to differ depending on whereabouts in the world you live. It's going to differ between, in like specifics of your community. It differs at different times. So what it means to be masculine today is something different from what it meant to be masculine 20 years ago. There are some consistent threads, but that's because the politics and the cultural expectations of what it means to perform male identity are very strong, and they're quite resilient. So you have very consistent ideas about it's men's responsibility to perform violence in acts of production of security, right? So men are expected to be the providers of security. It's why we pay cops and robbers and cowboys and Indians and soldiers and stuff. From a very young age, we're kind of socialized into this idea that it's our responsibility to kind of use violence to protect things that are, whether it's our family or our societies, that our nations, that are important to us. And I think you take that into a context where for, 20 odd years now, the mainstream media has been telling us and telling men that, in particular, that this religion such as Islam pose an existential threat to the continued existence of your society. And this is not an exaggeration. This is, George Bush coming out after 9/11 and saying they hate us, they hate our freedom, they hate our democracy, they want to take us back to a kind of barbarous age. It's them and us, it's classic kind of Orientalist framework. We can all say, oh yeah, we hear that, and we're above that, or we can kind of understand that that's just politics and yada yada yada. But I think that's been a constant background noise of the age of the war on terror, to have this message reiterated again and again and again, that we all know that we're in a state of real flux in political reality at the moment globally. The entire project of globalization at times feels like it's juddering and not quite clear about what its future is. So in the midst of all this flux, we have men who've been told about this existential threat, and I think it's quite easily to attribute these things together, to tie these things together, that the problems in our society are because of this generation long battle that we're having with the Oriental other, and it's perhaps unsurprising that aggression and violence is a response to that. But I think, you know, it's unsurprising because what I'm saying is that it's been mainstreamed, and whether we like it or not, you know, it has been part of the mainstream discourse. We can excuse it. We can say, oh, it was, you know, the context of 9/11. But, you know, as I said to my incoming students this year who are like 18 years old, you know, they don't know a non-war on terror reality. They're born into it. I've tried to think it's really interesting to try and explain to them that things weren't always like this. And they don't, like, they can read textbooks, they can read history that tells them that that's not the case. But that's no substitute for the lived experience. Their lived experience is the war on terror. And that's, for those of us who, I'm not sure exactly how old you are, Turnin, but I can remember.
Yeah, old enough. Yeah.
I remember Nirvana and Pearl Jam and you know, like Shell Suits in the 90s and stuff. You know, I remember another context. I remember when the even as a child, like, I remember a meta political discussion about things like the global village, the shrinking of time and space by the communications revolution, this kind of, you know, an optimism, you know, in political discourse that I think is, you know, has been completely, is not something that they're familiar with. It's certainly the kind of younger generation.
Yes, that's fascinating. I hadn't thought of that. There are people now that have lived only in a war on terror era. And it's very interesting because I'm 38, so I was very much grew up in the 90s. And I think my childhood was, well, in fact, I've always lived in London. So there was a lot of terrorism from IRA that happened in my area. And that was the kind of, the mainstream news' focus on terror. And then, of course, it all changed in 2001 as well. And I think what I'm finding interesting now is that, you know, in those times, say, for the IRA had a very distinct political motive. The war on terror, as shady as it is now, looking back on it at the time, it seemed to have a distinct political motive, the terrorism, about the war on it, supposedly, whether you agreed with it or not. We're now in a situation where, like, Britain's divided already. The US has got kind of democratic issues. A lot of the Western world has. France has got the Gilets Jaunes and, you know, unhappiness with Macron. Does terrorism still hold political power in a Western world that's kind of suffering from those democratic crises? I mean, New Zealand have taken quite decisive action, but we're seeing in the States it's not really changing anything. You know, does that kind of change the stance of terrorism or how it works?
Do you mean that, like, do those situations, like, I mean, you're talking about these kind of massive cleavages in Western society, right? Like, where these massive points of discontent, of anger, of serious, you know, this perhaps a battle between cosmopolitan liberal elite identities versus more kind of conservative nativist kind of, or even ethno-nationalist maybe perspectives, or, you know, very complicated kind of, you know, not even left and right necessarily kind of contentions. But, you know, it's, I don't see, like, organized, I see violence within all of these things, right? Like, sometimes that's kind of coming from the mainstream, you know, that's there's state versus, like, the Gilets Jaunes thing, you know, obviously that the identity of the Gilets Jaunes thing in terms of the politics of it very probably reflect really well that completely ambiguous, you know, often contrary political kind of pull of just anger, just resentment at current circumstances. Then you're seeing this, you know, very, very violent reaction by the state in that response as well. The Black Lives Matter thing, you know, has just been quite incredible in terms of seeing what the state's kind of reaction to pushback from the Black community in America. Despite, you know, I think very extremely well publicized, you know, cases and a general narrative now, it's still quite shocking to see continuing evidence, you know, week in, week out of police brutality there. So I think there are these cleavages in society, and I think that these cleavages between society and the state, and there's violence around all of it. But to what extent, you know, terrorism as a political tactic is kind of, you know, threatens to establish itself in those contexts, I don't really know.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And we'll be back with Kieran in a minute, but first, the inevitable.
Brexit fallout! Brexit fallout! Brexit fallout!
Here we are, and no longer will the UK be Brexiting on March the 29th at 11 p.m. Instead, it'll probably be leaving on April the 12th at 11 p.m, I guess, on the basis that May doesn't ever get a deal or her deal or whatever deal through, which isn't going to happen this week because there's now no meaningful vote. Or we might be leaving on May 22nd, also at 11 p.m. No one's really pointed that bit out. If everyone does vote for May's deal or an alternative deal is found, like, I don't know, an almond Brexit or a soy Brexit or an oat Brexit, or I guess May is carted off in some sort of Hannibal Lecter-style straitjacket hod carrier contraption and a chance that a sensible conversation might actually happen. So, no plan, no real time to do anything about it, some terrible plan or deus ex machina like, hey, everyone gets defeated by bacteria or something, and then very slightly more time to not do enough about it. Does this rule out a no deal? No, that can still happen after April the 12th, and all it means is that German-owned company Wepper can stockpile slightly more toilet paper for when the shit hits. Does it mean that MPs have to vote for whatever May's deal will end up being? No, but in fact MPs winning the vote on Letwin's amendment tonight means that there'll be indicative votes on Wednesday on what MPs might back so that May can go to the EU with something new that could be worked on, or something major that would need a ton of work, and then the EU may approve a much longer extension, but that would make the Conservative Brexiteers cry their baby pants because it'll be like their nanny wouldn't allow them a milk feed on their birthday like she always does, and they don't know how they'd cope. Of course, the EU could also go no sod off, but you know, in European or whatever they speak, and then bam, no deal all over again. Then, of course, there's all the other possibilities of another referendum or a general election or a no confidence vote or everyone eating experimental three-course chewing gum meals and inflating like a giant blueberry, rendering Parliament inactive. And of course, all of those could go wrong and then bam, no deal all up in your grill. It's like snakes and ladders, except all the ladders haven't passed EU health and safety regulation tests, and so they lead to snakes anyway. Obviously, there's now a pretty big voice for no Brexit at all, which you'd hope in a decent democracy with a leader who cared what the people thought would make a difference. 111 out of 121 polls and more than 300,000 people that have been taken since the start of 2018 have all favoured remaining in the EU over leaving. 7 were tied 50-50 and only 3 were majority leave. In fact, things started to change on polls towards favouring Remain from around July 2017, which is really odd because not much happened that month politically, except shaved rockhopper penguin Vince Cable became leader of the Liberal Democrats. Whoa! you don't think that Vince has more power than we could possibly imagine. I'm sorry. I'm actually just guessing it was probably that most people got more vitamin D than normal and stopped feeling so pissy. But who actually knows? Then, of course, this past week, there's now been the petition to revoke Article 50, which has reached over 5 million signatures, and the People's Vote March has had over 1 million. So that's a considerable amount showing resistance to the idea of Brexit at all, let alone a hard one. Revoking is, of course, a sensible idea, even if you're a Brexiteer, as that would mean the Article 50 time limit is removed and maybe a more sensible plan could be made over a longer amount of time without all of the bonkers promises. But the European Court of Justice did rule that an Article 50 revocation would be unequivocal and unconditional, which sounds a lot like if you go back on it, you can never leave. It doesn't sound very democratic for a democratic union, though, does it? Maybe, though, it's just the EU's way of making sure the UK actually sticks to something. You sort of think that after all this, they'd be so miffed that we'd come back, they'd have to give us a way to sod off again. Though now we've got the largest pro-Europe public protest in the continent, so it's possible that that was the post-breakup makeup that will make things okay again. Then, though, if we did revoke, how would you appease the side of the country you did vote leave and still want to? It won't work simply to run around shouting, you won, then you lost because you hadn't planned the winning. Get over it. Ah, it's all so tricky. And will May give a shit about any of this? Well, the petition has had over 100,000 signatures, which means it will be debated in Parliament, though I assume the possibility of revoking will be debated anyway, but having, you know, just a bit more than that signatures should at least make it be noticed, as should the march, although many marching on that were asking for a variety of outcomes from people's vote to revoking Article 50 overall, and someone who had a banner about being angry that Theresa May might stop her dog from going skiing. But we have Theresa May as Prime Minister, who wouldn't listen to a fire alarm if she decided there wasn't a fire, even if her shoes were alight at the time. Yes, it's also very worth pointing out that the opposition aren't really backing a people's vote or revoking Article 50 yet, though they have said that they might do if, you know, there's really no other options and the Labour idea of Brexit is definitely unable to happen. You know, like how it's constantly been rejected by Parliament, but, you know, somehow more definitely than that, like the very words that they might need to use for it are singed from all human memory, and all who try to work out what it was receive an electric shock of large proportions. Only then they may back a second referendum or something else, but probably something else. And that's only once they've discussed it among themselves, so that all their members and leadership can all say different things when interviewed. One thing that may make a difference, although probably not for some years, and by which time all the damage will be done and everyone involved will be dead or living in a tax haven, is a public inquiry, which apparently the civil service are already preparing for. You see, that's why it's pointless MPs blaming the civil service for anything to do with Brexit. They're already planning for a public inquiry into it that may not happen for ages. Of course they'd have sorted out Brexit properly if left to it. There's some support for it, not just from the civil service, but also Conservative peers, EU officials, and from within the Commons, with quotes of various backers comparing it to having their own version of Chilcot for Brexit. Which does, of course, mean that it could be pretty damning, but that won't stop the Prime Minister responsible from still earning lots of money elsewhere and regularly popping up on politics shows to annoy everyone by being undeservedly smug. The inquiry would be about if the right planning was made, spoiler no. The right advice given, spoiler no. About May's strict red lines that have hindered negotiating abilities, and of course, it would have to look into the vast amounts of legal cases made against the campaigns. I mean, just looking through, the mainly Conservative-backed official Leave campaign group Vote Leave was fined £61,000 by the Electoral Commission in 2018 for overspending, and then just last week, the Information Commissioner's Office fined them another £40,000 for sending out nearly 200,000 unsolicited texts, aka the other kind of dick pic. Then again, the Labour Leave campaign, an offshoot of Vote Leave, was fined £9,000 for failing to accurately register non-cash donations. Then the Leave.eu campaign, which isn't the official one, backed by human garbage compactor Aaron Banks, were fined £70,000 in May 2018 for failing to report spending, then another £120,000 in February last year for data breaches. So that's £110,000 of fines for the Vote Leave campaign for illegal electoral activity and £190,000 for Leave.eu. Oh, and the Britain Stronger in Europe got fined £1,250 last year for failing to deliver an accurate spending return. But look, basically, there's a whole shitload of doing things wrongly, and at no point has anyone official been remotely bothered. But come a public inquiry, oh, that could be pretty damaging for all the careers they'll no longer have, because they'll all be retired, and really damaging to that reputation they won't need, because they'll still be on the telly all the time. Yeah, the people will win eventually, just after a lot of losing, and then still no real winning. Oh God, make it stop. Where are you, bacteria? Where the hell are you? And now, back to Kieran.
I may have misunderstood your question there, if you want to clarify.
No, not at all. It's more like I was sort of thinking, I was reminded today of the awful murder of Joe Cox, just over 2 and a bit years ago now, I think a bit more. And, you know, and how actually that didn't then make any difference to the vote, or particularly, it was almost, I think, with news constantly changing and updating it, I don't know if it did anything for either, you know, for either the attacker's cause or Joe Cox's cause. You know, it's, and I feel like, again, in America, we're having all these kind of violent shootings, and it doesn't seem to change anything or do anything. Whereas previously, I would have thought that terrorist attacks had a political motive to either sway people to their cause or alternatively, you know, rally people against it. I just wondered if it was having, if any of it has the same effect anymore when everything is in chaos. That was my sort of question, really.
Well, I mean, I suppose perhaps we. You know, we always think our own immediate context is somehow different to any other time. You know, as you say, you grew up in London in the 80s and 90s, so you know, you knew about the chaos of terrorism, political violence. I grew up in a place called Strabane, in just a mile from the border in Northern Ireland, throughout the 80s. And you know, it's weird, right? Like, I was talking about this, like, people growing up with the norms of the war on terror. Like, I grew up in that situation, thought it was completely normal. So clearly it wasn't. You know, it was a highly securitized environment, you know, it's a kind of quasi war zone. But yeah, you tend to think of now as different, or now as some kind of exceptional time. And perhaps it is, but, you know, certainly in a global context. I think, you know, the point on Joe Cox is you know, an interesting one. Like, clearly, in the wake of Theresa May's speech the other night, which is quite, I think everyone found quite bizarre. And certainly, you know, again, I sympathize with MPs who found that actually quite scary, that they felt like that was almost like a call to arms by the public against them. You know, I'm sure a lot of them are remembering what happened to Joe Cox. I mean, we can also forget somebody, you know, like a guy tried to attack Jeremy Corbyn at one point outside a mosque, and you know, like these things are happening. I think in that sense, I mean, those are a reflection that very far right politics exist in this country. I think there's all, they're kind of referred to in these kind of cryptic terms about people taking to the streets if there being violence if the Brexit outcome isn't what, you know, the referendum kind of dictated or indicated it would be, as in terms of how we're interpreting that. But that is to say, I think really more than saying something about terrorism per se, it's saying that, you know, fascism and the far right, which is an extreme, you know, has always been a historically violent actor in British politics, and that's not something new, is here, right? It's in the background. It's in all this stuff about Tommy Robinson and, you know, kind of groups that, you know, the Football Lads Alliance. You know, like, I've been to one of, like, the counter demos for those guys in London. You know, they turn up in numbers. You know, it's like maybe only a few hundred, but they have numbers, and they're willing to fight in the streets. Like, that kind of, you know, they're willing to do violence. They're pretty radical actors. You know, we don't call that terrorism per se, but, you know, they are violent extremist political actors who are willing to go on the streets and for when the cause and the timing is right. And that is, yes, I think that's something we should be really worried about. I mean, it does not, and I think this goes back to a broader point that perhaps is relevant to this whole discussion, does not seem to be something that we tend to think about as being, that's what a form of terrorism is, a political terrorism is in this country. Terrorism is, by writ of the kind of discourse of the age of the war on terror, is generally speaking something done by them to us, whoever them is. It's an other that we define it as. Even when it comes from within our own communities, it's, well, that's something from outside, that's some outside influence, that's not something to do with our society when clearly it is.
Is that, I mean, it's been sort of more and more clear that you know, that far-right fascism has been very much normalised by mainstream media. You know, I think on the night of the New Zealand terror attacks, Newsnight interviewed a leader of a far-right British group, which is a very bizarre thing to do. Obviously, the way in which New Zealand have dealt with it, and Jacinda Ardern, she's kind of said that she doesn't want to name the attacker and doesn't want to glorify them. Do you think that could be the beginning of a change in understanding how to deal with these events? Or, you know, because it really, it feels like, at what point do you think it will get to before kind of media understands that maybe we need to look at things differently?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think perhaps that is the question of ultimate importance here. And, you know, I realize I say the media a lot, and I talk about it like it's some homogenous thing. And again, it kind of like some other and stuff. Like, but I participate in it. You participate in it. You know, like we you know, it's a part of public discourse, right? But there are respecting that there are power hierarchies within that system, and particular institutions and voices have more weight than others and have a better ability to shape that discourse. Yeah, you know, I think what happened with the BBC, the news, and I think, I mean, without wanting to put too fine a point on it, I found that to be in disgraceful taste. I really did. I thought it was, and unfortunately, it reflects. To me, it's like that is. I know what you're saying about New Zealand's Prime Minister, and I think there's always a kind of reaction to this that is. You know, going back to the days of, like, you know, Obama kind of weeping after the Sandy Hook shootings and stuff, of like, we must be better than this. We must go above. We must, you know, our societies can persevere and kind of bring out the best in us and stuff. But on the flip side, you see this thing with Newsnight. And to me, that is the thing that tells you, actually, we are quite incapable within the current kind of structures of how we think about things like political violence, and indeed structural violence like racism, that produces it. We are quite incapable of reflecting on how power and the media kind of interact to produce narratives that cause this stuff. How, you know, the political and economic structures of our society kind of produce it. You know, it's fine to say very nice things that, you know, kind of quasi West Wing statements of he shall not be named, and, you know, he does not define us, or you know, we're better than this kind of stuff. But, you know, when you still think about something like white supremacist, you know, Nazi violence executing Muslim people on Friday prayers in the most vulnerable moment, refugees fleeing conflicts, and your kind of instinctual reaction is to balance that with, you know, to allow space for people to express legitimate concerns, and I'm doing my bony ears here that you can't see, or you know, to talk about their grievances, even if only to dismiss them, surely, and to have people ridicule them, it doesn't, you know, it's legitimating it, and. You know, I noticed the same thing on the Friday morning. I wanted a break from the news. I listened to BBC Radio 6, which is a fabulous radio station, my favorite, and listened to music. The music's interrupted by a news bulletin. The bulletin is the New Zealand's Prime Minister announcing that she's interested in pursuing a gun control crackdown on the kind of the sale of the arms involved in the attack. She speaks briefly for about, I think, 10 seconds or whatever it is of the bulletin, and then the 10 seconds is balanced by a gun lobbyist talking about not doing anything rash in response to this event. So, I mean, it's not an, you know, this is not an isolated, the thing that happened with Newsnight is no way isolated. This is, and I think people, you know, Brexit is probably less of my kind of interest area in terms of as a political kind of you know, the thing that you really want to talk about a lot. I kind of try to take a step back from that, but you know, I think that's a question. That's a thing that people have been angry about in terms of that, you know, that, that things about evidence have to be balanced by people having beliefs about things. So, you know, that you're not always weighing two equal things. I mean, it's, in my case, it's something I get really angry about because I see it happening with things like climate change. You know, you have to balance somebody saying that you know, we have 12 years to do something of any substance to have any chance of basically maintaining a habitable world. And then that's balanced against somebody saying, again, oh, let's not be too rash here because, you know, we don't really know what we know and this kind of thing. That's all a long way of saying, going back to the point that I'm not sure we have the capacity to really deal with underlying causes here, because we feel the need, we feel this instinctual need to say everything has balance, every story has two sides, you know, like that I think that unfortunately that's a norm that's like crept into the nature of political journalism in a lot of contexts, and that has the effect of being extremely conservative and being extremely restrictive in terms of, you know, without being too academic, you know, emancipatory potentialities, you know, like that there isn't, it locks us into a journey that we find it incredibly hard to get out of, because it's hard to generate a political narrative that says, no, look, this is just wrong. You know, this is just, there is no excuse for this. There is no grievance to be addressed here. And if it is, it's something to do with politics and society that we need to have a very serious conversation about.
So this is the case with nearly every interview I've done on this podcast for the last 3 years. It you sort of end up going, oh, wow, things are quite bleak. Is there any way that you would see, you know, it's obviously a very tricky situation. There's a lot of reasons for political violence at the moment. Is there anything that you think could be done to minimise it, or should be done? I mean, social media regulations is one of the things that keeps coming up, which, as we've discussed earlier, doesn't seem like it would really do anything other than infuriate people and possibly sort of lead to a more authoritarian atmosphere. What would your, you know, from all your studies, is there anything you could see happening that may reduce political violence in the future?
Yeah, that's a good question.
It's a big question. Sorry, it's a large. Yeah,
it is a very big question. But you know, it's very worth trying to engage with it. I mean, it's a big question. Therefore, you have to kind of talk big. And you know, I do think as a society, you know, we never escaped the financial crisis, right? Like that's, to me, that's what that this, you know, a lot of this, like I'm, you know, like, kind of a lefty, so I turn, you know, I kind of look at the material basis of society as much as I look at like things like identity as well. But the, you know, we have been squeezed, right? You know, I don't think it's fairly obvious to people, I think, that, you know, we've had a very difficult few years in this country in the context of austerity. You know, you walk down the street in London, you know, you kind of understand that, like, I pay, you know, whatever money I have goes into, like, usually paying off, like, the rent, like, the mortgage of some guy who owns, like, several properties. I'm scraping to try and get by. If, you know, if you've got a family, you know, you're trying to provide for them. It's incredibly desperate, like, to just kind of scratch out a living. And in the meantime, you're, like, looking around you and you're seeing these, like, glass temples and spires reaching up into the sky that are like clearly the result of this very, 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 very disaggregated existence in this society, very, very deeply hierarchical separation between us and what's the richest people in society have, you know, without being too crass in the Occupy slogan, you know, the 1% and the rest of us. And it's not even the 1%, right? It's like the not 1%. And I feel like that's just always going to create huge resentment, right? Like there's an anger there that people have that they don't even know, probably don't even know they have, or they don't know how to express it. And I do think that until there's, you know, we know that like this stuff about Brexit is probably a, you know, it's a massive distraction to, all sorts of things that we need as a society to start engaging with immediately, things like climate change, things like automation, the massive changes in technology is producing, which should be emancipatory, that should be freeing us to do things to have better lives, but clearly are not. And I just don't see us engaging with these things at all. And to me, this kind of goes back to this whole question about media's framing of crisis, and the Westminster bubble of media. So it is. I think to a certain degree is obsessed with something like Brexit, because it's an unsolvable puzzle that you can just have, just never ending content about, a story that just never stops. And they all say that they hate it, but they also kind of obsess over it. Whereas, we have bigger problems, I know everyone's, Brexit is like, well, it's the ultimate problem because we can't do anything if that ends up being a disaster or whatever. But it seems like every Western society is plagued by their own Brexit thing, the thing that's stopping them from engaging meaningfully in the things that would actually change our lives for the better. And at some point you have to say that, well, it's not really about any individual political thing. This is about the structures of power within our societies. So the short answer is, I think we need to challenge those structures. We need to get better at pushing back against, the framing of what is politically possible, Newsnight telling us that we have to kind of accept that there's both sides to fascist violence is not good enough, right? We have to be saying something, there must be a more inspiring message. I think one of the interesting things about like the Obama administration, right, is it ran on the slogan of hope and change, right? Because in 2008, 2009, people desperately needed that. I don't think anything's changed except hope died, And unfortunately, Obama bears a huge degree of responsibility for that. He'll be held up as this amazing president between George Bush and Donald Trump. But it was, to me, it's like we know that the problems with the administrations like Donald Trump's and George Bush, we know the problems with the Theresa May's administration, and God forbid something like Boris Johnson or even worse follows it on. We know how bad those are. We know, but I think it's about pushing the capacity of those forces that claim to be progressive to do something better is really where we, I think, if you're interested, and I'm making huge presumptions about probably what people want in terms of their politics, but if we want something better, we want something that doesn't mire us in the kind of hateful, resentful, angry kind of political discourse that produces radicalization amongst a variety of different identities, and we need to be aspiring to something else. And that's, I suppose, maybe that's the simplest point. At this point, I don't see us aspiring to very much at all. And I think it's very much, it's easy to see how we become very insular and angry when we don't have something to work towards.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I mean, it's not mean to trivialise that much, but I always think it's incredible to look at Brexit and all that. But I was always sort of disappointed that none of the arguments were, if you're going to make things up, why not make them really positive? Free cake for everyone, more trips to the zoo, more lovely picnics on a sunny day. It always sort of made me sad that if you're gonna pull facts out of the air, make things up, why do it have to be so negative and so hateful? And I would much rather try and persuade people over to my side by, I think I was a member of the Icelandic, the Reykjavik mayor, John Nahr, a few years ago, who's a comedian who became a mayor, and he won his campaign despite having no political background, because he simply said, there'll be free towels at the swimming pool, and there'll definitely be a polar bear at the zoo, and it was all positive. And people went, oh, what a lovely change after the crash and everything. And he got in with a resounding success. And I thought, I just would love to see some of that, really. It would be a positive change. Right. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me, Kieran. One last question, which is something that I ask all the guests on this podcast, which simply is a kind of attempt to expand knowledge and a search for proper knowledge and answers and opinions. I just wondered who you would recommend that listeners follow. Obviously, apart from yourself and all your work and your course that you teach, who would you recommend that listeners follow or read up on or listen out for on information and views and studies on political violence and terrorism? Who are your go-to experts?
Well, I think because of perhaps it's, you know, because precisely it's not the social media thing, and because it's not, it's something that I did mention. I mentioned Judith Butler's work on performance and masculinity. She has a range of just fascinating work on identity and political violence. And, you know, I think there's probably loads of things that I could recommend you that are works on hardcore terrorism and about how people get radicalized and stuff like this. This is much more kind of, I think, broad and useful to any people interested in any walk of politics body of work. So there's a variety of quite short texts that she's done on memory, on violence, on grieving and things like that, which, so Judith Butler, I would recommend because I think it has relevance way beyond anything to do with terrorism, and perhaps getting at this idea of maybe not focusing so much on negative. To me, is something I read and I found it to be a transformative text in terms of my politics. So I would deeply recommend it to all your readers if they haven't heard of her, engaged with her before.
Many thanks to Kieran for that. And that sort of chat is why I'm not allowed to interview anyone, say, on the telly, because I just listened to all his answers and kept thinking, yeah, I agree with that. And I'd have then found it sort of impossible to do an Emily Maitlis or a John Humphreys and throw out of nowhere something like, but don't these opinions mean actually you're the terrorist? Or shouldn't everyone just do national service? Or, so once again, it's the failings of the Labour Party, you know, for no real reason. Actually, I think I'm quite happy just doing this podcast. What am I on about? You can find Kieran on Twitter at Kieran Gillespie with the link in the podcast blurb. And he currently teaches on a number of subjects at Surrey University, ranging from theories to international relations to terrorism studies. So if you are one of the younger listeners of this show and that's your bag, do consider it on your UCAS form. Is that still a thing? They haven't replaced it with a virtual form or an app where you play a game and depending on how you do, you get given a placement. I honestly have no idea. I'm so old. Send me more ideas for who to talk to on the show. Everything in the news is Brexit right now, but there are other important political things going on in the UK and rest of the world that need a bit of voice time. What are they? Who should I talk to about them? Will they reply to my emails? Where am I? Who's taken my shoes? If you can help with any of those questions, please do get in touch at Parlborough on Twitter, the Partly Political Broadcast group on Facebook, the contact page on partlypoliticalbroadcast.co.uk, or email me at partlypoliticalbroadcast@gmail.com. Or, you know, you could organise a massive march through central London with the sole purpose of telling me who to chat to on the show. And as I completely miss it to deal with a vomiting baby, I'll occasionally try to work out exactly who you mean based on a few sarcastic banners. Is that a pun? What are you dressed as? Ah, this is complicated. As always, it's probably just a lot easier to email me. And that's all for this week's Partly Political Broadcast podcast. Thanks to you, the good people of Poddington, for electing this to be your weekly town crying. And please do donate to the Ko-fi or Patreon if you can, review the show on your pod applicants of enjoyment, and generally just spread the word about the show and say nice things about us whenever you speak to your mum. Yeah, nice one to Acast for bear-hugging this show in its audio embrace, to my brother The Last Skeptic for Melodic Times, and to Cat Day for typing up the linear liner notes yet again, goddammit. This will be back next week when the Conservative Party spends 2 days of Brexit planning, panically putting out lost person posters for David Lidlington, only to find out that he was right next to them all along. Bye! This week's show is brought to you by Brexit Alternatives. Hey, did you know British humans are the only animals to have Brexit, which just seems unnatural, right? Blur! Why not substitute that unhealthy Brexit for some of our naturally sourced alternatives, like shooing an angry goose, screaming at a butcher, or rapidly passing your bare hands over gravel? You'll find that they give you much the same results for less than half the time and even lower cost. Brexit Alternatives, get your natural hit of sheer pointless frustration and self-harm now.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.